there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Ah yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy, gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Simon Hughes here, and thank you very much again for tuning in to this podcast. This actually is the first part of a two-part special because it's the 80th birthday of Geoffrey Boycott coming up on the 21st of October. So to commemorate that and a fascinating life, I went up to his house in Boston Spa a couple of weeks ago, did an afternoon with him, and of course he's had a very rich and fascinating career. So we really sort of teased out the interesting parts of it. So we'll get into that in a minute, and I've divided it into two parts. We'll have one part today and then one part next week as it comes up to his 80th birthday. Just before we get into Geoffrey, just a little bit of an advance warning. Simon Mann and I have created this virtual cricket club, a live video stream every Thursday night, 7 p.m, to interview a leading player or ex-player, to try and give you the opportunity as well to chat with them. So if you connect to the live stream, you can actually ask them direct questions, these characters that we're bringing onto our show. We've got Angus Fraser, the director of cricket of Middlesex, former, of course, Middlesex and England fast bowler. He's coming on the show this Thursday, 7 o'clock start. It's streamed on Crowdcast, which is www.crowdcast.io/e/Angus-Fraser. But also another way of getting to it is through the Patreon site, which we've signed up to as well. And that's a patronage site in which you pay a small amount per month. Just a £9 contribution to all our work, and you join a community. And we will be then uploading a stream every week with some leading players. We're hoping to get the likes of Stuart Broad, Mark Wood, Joe Root and others onto this live stream at 7 o'clock on a Thursday night. And you can ask them direct questions and also enter a competition to win prizes as well. So we're really trying to create a sort of new cricket community where we keep the conversation going during the dark days of winter, Thursdays at 7 p.m. Look out also for notification on social media about that. But this first one is Angus Fraser, 7 p.m. this Thursday night. So hope you can join us for that. It is free, by the way. Okay, let's get into Geoffrey now. I tried to take a sort of fairly slow perambulation through his incredible life. And I started out by saying to him that, well, his famous mum, who died in 1978, would be absolutely incredulous at the amazing life he's had. How would she regard it?
She would be proud, but she wouldn't know what to make of it, because we grew up in a coal mining community, they were, serving a particular Hemsworth coal mine. My father was a miner. Tough way to earn a living, that, going down a coal mine 5 and 6 days a week and trying to make ends meet on... Well, by the time I was 10, I think the gross wage was about £10. It was a tough life, but we had the basics of being loved, looked after. We always had food on the table. Our parents were good, and so were the people around. So we had the basic bringing up of life that was important, not the trappings of wealth. And so I don't feel I missed out on anything, because I had good people, not only good parents, but a good community. In terraced houses, people helped each other. You could borrow a, if you'd run out of milk because you waited for the milkman in the morning to deliver, you didn't have a car to go and get any, you know. And when the shops had closed, you'd run out of milk, run out of sugar, you borrowed from the next door neighbour. And then next day, you paid them back. And same with the coal. Because the only good thing about being a miner was, if your father was a miner, you got 1 ton of coal a month, free. That was brilliant, because at least you had heating. And you didn't really need 12 tons of coal, maybe 8, 9. And so what people used to do, you're not allowed to sell it, they gave it away to widows or widowers, who used to get 6 tons, which wasn't quite enough, especially with the rough English winter. And so people used to give them buckets, put it in their coal house for them and that. And it was a great upbringing. No money, no trappings of anything, but wonderful, warm environment. So she would have thought, she couldn't believe it. No, she would have believed it. She never believed it when people rang up. Once I had a bit of money and got a phone at home, I was playing for Yorkshire in England. She couldn't believe how often the phone rang. No, she would have had, because it's been a roller coaster life. Not by choice, but it has.
More peaks than troughs, I'd say. More mountains than valleys.
But they always say, the bigger you are, you know, the more you fall. And in the media, what we have today and have had for 20, 30 years, it's got very intrusive on anyone who's well-known. I don't like to say famous, but people are well-known. And it's got very intrusive as they fight each other for circulation. And they've changed from, I mean, they've been under pressure now for 30 years from television, more radio. And so they're looking for sensationalism and salacious things. It's not the kind of news that we used to have. It's changed a great deal.
Mm.
So that affects somebody like me who's been up there, what do they call it? The Aussies call it the tall poppy syndrome. You know, if you grow and are up there and right top of the tree, then they want to lop your head off, you see. They want you to fall, and then they want to try and pick you up again and then lop you off again. To them, it's a game. It's not a game to people like me. It's our lives. And they don't think like that. They just think about circulation. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And there are a lot of good people working in the media. I have to say that. A lot of good, honest, decent people, but there are others much more scrupulous.
What about your first home? Describe your first home.
Well, I can't really, because apparently I was born at 2 Milton Terrace, which is in the house where I lived most of the time. But I was born at 2 Milton Terrace, which was the first house at the bottom of the row in Fitzwilliam. And my parents then moved to Ackworth, a mile and a half away as the crow flies, 2 miles maybe. You could walk there comfortably in those days. And my father originally came from Shropshire. My mother was the Yorkshire person. My father came from Shropshire to work in the coal mines. And he had other family, Boycotts, who lived in Ackworth. So they went to live in Ackworth for a few years. And then they came back, apparently when I was still quite small, to 45 Milton Terrace, where I lived then, until my mother died in 60... What? My father died in 67, my mother died in 78, and I left there 2 years later, a year and a half later, because my other two brothers had already married and gone. So that's what I remember. 45 Milton Terrace is what I remember, not number 2.
And have you revisited it?
Oh, yeah. I revisited it when I got my cancer in 2002. After all the treatment, the end of... it was after Christmas. My brother had a house there, my middle brother, Tony and Marlene. And he told me what it was like and that, so I went to see. couldn't believe what it was like. I mean, it was like a war zone. If you'd have had a 4x4 and dark glasses and a repeating gun, you'd have thought, you know, gangsters had come. There were mounds of rubble around in a row of houses, of what, 20, 21, 22 houses. Half of them were derelict. The windows were knocked out. There'd be some cardboard up or just broken windows. And there were some good people like my brother living in a lovely, nice terrace house, keep beautiful, lots of people. But their houses were not saleable. Nobody wanted to buy in that thing. And the council were just letting it go to rack and ruin. And then eventually, when everybody went, they hoped to flatten it out and build again. But some people, some absent landlords, had bought, say, 4 or 5 holes at houses, I was told. And they were holding the council to a bit of hostage to get as much money as they could, and they wouldn't sell. And they knew that the council needed the houses. Well, and I looked at 45 Milton Terrace, the original, the whole row had gone. It was just rubble, bricks. You know, it's like being in Lebanon where there's war zone going on.
So no plaque saying Geoffrey Boycott lived here then?
No, the house had gone, so you couldn't put a plaque on any of that bloody row had been got down.
What about your first memory of a cricket match that you either played in or watched?
Oh, I can remember where our first match I saw was 1952 at Headingley. India versus England. Fred Truman's debut. And I can remember, I went a couple of days. And in the second innings, Alec Betsy got a wicket. He's supposed to tell it. And Fred got 3 in 8 balls. There were none for 4. You've got to remember that. I haven't got a bloody run. And, he was my idol for...
So you were about, what, 12?
11.
11.
52, I was 11.
Yeah.
And went to watch him. George Heppard took me and my batting idol was Tom Graveney. He made 70-odd runs. Elegant player, front, back foot.
Was that when he became your idol then?
Yes, because I saw him make runs beautifully. And I was lucky enough. 1966 at Lord's. He was picked to play, I was, and I actually batted with him. He got 90-odd, I got 60-odd. I batted with him for quite a while. That was nice.
So that's batting with your original hero.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But going back to that 1952 match, do you think that sort of whetted your appetite for becoming a cricketer then?
No. I had already liked cricket from being 9. No, I love cricket.
So where did it start then? Where did the sort of, as a 9-year-old, what captured your interest?
My Uncle Algie took me. He had the most effect on my cricket career, more than anybody. He played as a bowler for Acworth Cricket Club, which, as I said, 2 miles as a crow's fly easily, and by bus maybe 4 or 5 miles, you know, going have to go round the road. And he was a medium-fast bowler, swing and seam, and he took me as a 9-year-old to Acworth, and he'd give me the bat, and I'd bat while he bowled and loosened up, and I'd feel them for the others, and I put the tins up. You're too young to remember putting the tins up on the scoreboard, aren't you? The old scoreboard.
I remember that.
Good.
What, metal numbers?
Yeah.
You think? Yeah.
And then I let out a score, and at tea time, you always get the ladies made some sandwiches and cakes, didn't you? And you get a bottle of pop from him. End of the match, you go to the Boot and Shoe Inn. Most local cricket grounds have a local pub, don't they? Everybody there. I'd sit there outside with Chris from Pop, and then he'd put me on the bus home, and I'd take his gear. A bowler, he didn't have any batter pads, he had his boots, and I took them in a case, and I took them home, and my grandma lived 2 streets away, so I took them to her. She would wash them that night, so they were clean overnight, ready for next day, he could play again. I didn't have 2 pairs of everything, just 1 pair. They were ordinary coal miners. And then I go 2 streets up home, have some supper and get washed and bed. I'd had a wonderful day. That's how I started my interest in cricket, with my Uncle Algie.
So, you know, that was your uncle who was a bowler. What about your first bat? Someone gave you a bat? I mean, you know, you are famous, obviously, for batting. So where did that start? And did it start
the first
from your
bat
first bat
I can remember my parents bought me was a William Lambert.
Yeah.
I had no idea who the hell he was. It was a wonderful bat, loved it. Oh, treasured it, linseed oiled it, knocked it in. Oh, beautiful. And I looked it up some time ago, this, checked it, and William Lambert was an actual person. And I looked up in 1801, he was born, and he played in the early 1800s for Surrey.
Right.
Yeah. And he was the first man to score a century in each innings. Amazing, that. Good. That was at Lord's in July 1817.
Just absolutely after Lord's had been created. That was 3 years after Lord's was relocated.
And soon after that, I found, which is much more laughable, he was banned for life soon after for match fixing. Apparently, he was a brilliant single wicket cricketer, which that was very important at that time. They played lots of single wicket competitions. Yes. But he got banned after being the first man for two centuries. I had to laugh, but it was my favourite first bat. I had no idea for years who he was. I'm going to be honest. I had no idea. I also remembered William Lambert, but I've looked it up since some time ago, and I know that's true.
Because I remember the name, actually, and I'm sure I had a William Lambert bat as well. Mm. Didn't make as much use of it as you, but, you know, I scored a few runs at school, actually. Okay, so that was your
first... In your dreams.
Yeah, right. So that was your first bat. What about your first sort of competitive match? I don't mean professional, but, you know, as a young boy, what was your first match that you remember?
I can't remember the very first. I remember the first time I played proper game. I think it was, if I'm correct, it was 1951, was Festival of Britain year. You are too young to remember that.
Yeah.
And they organised all kinds of things. And the one thing they organised, which interested me, was a competition in your area. So whatever area you were in, the primary schools had a competition of 20-over cricket. Yeah, surprise, surprise. Now, the IPL 2020 is the thing. And I'm talking now about 1951. So there's nothing new in life, just gets wrapped up in different Christmas paper. And that was the first proper cricket I ever played. And I played for Fitzwilliam County Primary School. In our area, different teams, it was a knockout competition. I can't remember how many matches we played. But we did well. We won some. We got to the semi-final. And we lost the semi-final. It turned out I was the star player. But I was fastest bowler and opening bat. And... my dad, in watching and getting involved in the fielding, threw a ball. It bounced up, hit me in the eye, and it obviously swollen up and everything, and I couldn't see properly. So I had to bat and with great difficulty, and we lost the semi-final. The following year, we got to the final, and we lost that. So they kept this competition going a little bit. And I know it was in one of the papers. I can't remember which one. If anybody knows, they could write in and tell you to tell me. But one of the papers printed every week a huge full page of all the teams that were playing in competition. And they gave away a Len Hutton Gradage bat to the best batsman, best bowler, best all-rounder each week. And I got 7 wickets for 9 runs. Everybody thought, I'm bound to get the bowling prize. And there's a guy got 7 for 8 from Cudworth near me. And doing Test Match Special a few years ago, he actually emailed Adam and told me his name was Nicholas Horn. That's right, he got 7 for 8 and he got the bowling bat. He got the bat for bowling, 7 for 8. And then out of the blue, I got a bat, a Len Hutton bat. I got the all-rounders prize 1 week. I got 6 for 10, bowling the side out cheaply, and then I think we had about 50-odd to knock off, and I got 45 not out. Amazing. It was presented to me, this white bat, black writing, Grady's, Len Hutton, presented to me by the headmaster, right in front of all the school. And that's my first memories of playing proper cricket was 2020.
Moving on from that, what about your first 100? Did you make 100 as a 12-year-old in some school?
No, you've caught me out there. I can't remember any like Bradman getting big hundreds in early teens. I tried to look up my first 50, and I'm pretty sure it was when I went to Hemsley Grammar School, 24th of May, 1957.
16 years old.
I was 16. I opened the batting, and I made 52 out of 140 for 8. And then we bowled Castleford Grammar School out for 53 and won the match. That's the only thing I can remember, to be honest.
Mm. What about your first coach that had an influence on you? I mean, I'm sure you had people at school and things, but who was the first coach who really had an impact on you?
Johnny Lawrence, without a shadow of a doubt. He played 10 years for Somerset after the Second World War. And he started, one of the first people to start an indoor school. And in the winter, I mean, pay wasn't great. It was probably slightly above average playing the cricket, but you were doing something you loved. Johnny played for Somerset as a wrist spinner, leg spinner. He was a good bowler, big friend of George Herbert Hurst, Herbert Sutcliffe. For a winter employment, he bought a house that had a big garden, where the big garden shed, you know, and so it had lots of windows in it, a small wall, and he made this into an indoor school. And so there was plenty of light in the daytime, put some strip lighting up, and it was very primitive, put some rubber mats down that spun, and he had an indoor cricket school. And he did coaching with kids like me when I was about 9, 10, to Saturday mornings. And so I used to go. We couldn't afford it at first. I mean, came back, it was 6 shilling for coaching, 3.11 to catch 2 buses. And they couldn't afford it. It was 10 shillings nearly of my father's £10 wage. So my Uncle Algie paid 2 and 6. My mum's sister, my Auntie Annie and Uncle Jack, lovely man, they paid 2 and 6, so my parents only had to pay 5 shilling, only, still a lot. And I did that every Saturday morning in the winter for years until I was big enough, good enough to go in the evenings with the men. And they paid for it all the time. And it was the best time of my life. And that's how I learned to play spin, because it turned, it was rubber. And actually, remember Jackie Birkinshaw, played for Leicester, a bit for England?
Yeah.
Jackie lived about 2 doors away. And I used to, every Saturday morning, be first there, I used to knock on the door, Mrs. Birkinshaw would come. I said, Mrs. Birkinshaw, will you tell your Jackie I'm here? So she'd get him out of bed, because he's a bit of a lad then, he was. And he'd come in to bowl at me with Johnny, his off-spinners, and he'd always bring a big mug of tea. Partly in the winter, remember how cold it is, snow on the ground, ice and what have you, oh, terrible weather. And he put his hands, his fingers round the mug of tea to warm them. You can't spin the ball if your fingers are like icicles. Mm. Warm the tea and give him a drink, because we went into this greenhouse first thing in the morning, you can imagine, trying to put your whites on, changing your trousers. Oh, you did that quick, I can tell you. It was freezing. There was no heating. He couldn't afford heating, John. Even when I played for England, I went back to see him all the time. He knew my batting inside out. We had no videos like they have today. We couldn't see. If you can see everything, well, it's easy to find faults and how to improve. You had to trust people's eyes. And we'd just talk about it and say, I think you do this or that. And he'd sort of take it all on trust. You couldn't see anything. He was one of the best coaches, because he made it fun. When you're a kid, you need cricket to be fun. You can't talk too much technique to him, else it gets boring. Because it's hard, you know, as a youngster, to keep your left elbow up and play straight. You haven't got the strength to make the ball go anywhere. You want to whack it cross-bat, and then it goes. And that's the fun when you hit it. But he'd make it a game. He was always positive. always trying to encourage you to do it rather than telling you it was, you know, you can tell kids at 20 that, hey, that's rubbish, you've got to do it this way. You can't be telling kids that. You've got to encourage them, you've got to pick them up, you've got to keep them interested, you've got to keep them confident, you've got to keep them wanting to come back. And he was everybody's favourite uncle, favourite grandpa. He was fantastic.
Because you kindly gave me a copy of that book about Bradman.
Yes.
When did you sort of first lock on to Bradman and be interested in his phenomena?
I was still quite young, because the one thing that sticks in my mind that when I was young was one time, I think it was the last time he came to England in 48, I could be wrong on that, but I think it was the last time, and he came round San Francisco way and then across America to come to England instead of coming the other way, right? Which they normally did then on the boat. And he actually went to Canada, and he wrote that Vancouver was the prettiest cricket ground in the world. And that stuck with me. Now, I must have been young. I don't know, 11, 12, 13, something like that. Then I know in 1964, so I'm 23, I've just played for England. I'm playing with Yorkshire. I actually went with Yorkshire to Vancouver and saw it for myself. We went on a tour of America. We went to New York, Washington, Toronto, Calgary, Vancouver, Los Angeles, and then to Bermuda.
Did the Vancouver ground live up to expectations?
It's on a point with water, three sides around. Brockton Point, it's called. And the pitch, from one end where you look at the bowler bowling to you, behind him is water because it's surrounded by, I mean, a lot of water. This is not some pokey stream. This is the sea. And behind are the Rockies. The greenery for a part, and then it gets to the snow-capped Rockies. The view is absolutely stunning. And every now and again, I can picture it from my right. If I'm batting and looking at the Rockies, somebody's bowling from there. The city was on my right, and big ocean-going liners come past behind the bowler's arm with the Rockies in the background, snow-capped. Absolutely stunning. And it's on an Indian reservation. There were three original totem poles there. I mean, it's absolutely, you go, wow, this was. I mean, we played on mat on grass. I mean, you weren't perfect grass pitches or anything. It was just enlightening. Then I played in Los Angeles, and in Los Angeles we had the Sir C. Aubrey Smith Memorial Ground. If you look at him, he was a famous England cricketer.
I know about him. You know, he captained England and they got sacked.
Yes.
Dropped after one game,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he did.
They took five though as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's happened to all kinds of people
and
in England.
And then he became a film star, didn't he, after that?
He was a film star. Because I remember Carter closely winning the toss and saying, right, Geoffrey, you bat and don't get out, we're going horse riding. Because there was horse riding around the cricket ground. And I've got photos of him in a Stetson and Richard Hutton and people, and they're all waving at me, don't get out. They wanted to enjoy the horse riding. Ron Roberts did the tour, and he got Sobers to guest for us.
What, for Yorkshire?
No. Sobers played for Yorkshire.
Yes.
The best cricketer I've ever seen. And he played for Yorkshire. He came in to play in Bermuda. Bermuda was like part of West Indies.
So you played with the cigar field,
didn't Yeah.
You?
I can picture the match. We played on concrete. Matting on concrete. And let me tell you, that makes every fast bowler like Michael Holding. It bounces and zips through like lightning. And we were three, four down in no time. He's bowled. I mean, they had a guy called Clarence Parfitt who was a quick left armer. Polished off three or four of our lads. Jeez, the ball's zipping through. I'm a young kid at this day. I'm not, you know, a player of years later. And Garfield come in and bowled him a couple of bounces. I remember him saying, "You cut that out, man. No more of them." I thought, this is all right. He was gone, wasn't he? He was the best player in the world. And so at the end of the over, I went down to him. I said, "Hey, what about me at the other end?" So he called the captain and we said, "Listen, and no more to him too. We both got hundreds." It was wonderful. I'd like to bat with him all the time. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, we both got hundreds.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, so I played with Gary, yeah.
So that's is that the only time you've ever played in the same team as him? Because that's quite a record if you batted together once and both got 100.
Yeah, definitely. He just told him, no more to him too. You think Viv Richards was good? Let me tell you, this guy was special. Never mind the bowling, just the batty. I mean, he did get the world record, you know. People forgot that. Talk about him being an all-rounder. He started batting for West Indies at number 8. Number 8, and he gets the world record within a few weeks. Well, a couple of months. 365. I mean, the mind boggles the amount of runs. God, he never...
What's the most you've scored in innings?
Oh, miles behind him. 260-odd. I've done that half a dozen times. Something, but he's 365.
You should have played more shots, then you'd have got past 300.
Well, I made better pitches and better bats. I like today. They were uncovered pitches half the time.
So you were, at that point, you were 24. And when did you first wear glasses? When was the... And when was the transition from glasses to contacts? Did you play in glasses as a little boy?
No, I was all right until I was at Hemsworth Grammar School. And then I don't know, probably test exams in the winter, doing a lot of swatting. You had to swat and do homework and that. I couldn't quite see the... You know, the blackboard where the teachers put the chalk on and people start saying, "You want to get some glasses, you know." Well, you don't want glasses if you're a young kid. You hate them, don't you? You don't want them. But eventually it got to me. So I went to see an optician. And obviously he said, I needed glasses. Oh, God, I hated them. And I hated them. I still do. There's very little I hate in life. I think hate's terrible. I use that as a, just, you know, the having to wear. I played football for Leeds United under 18s. I played in cricket and getting on. I played for Yorkshire Schoolboys, Yorkshire under 18s. And there I am at about 16, 17, having to wear glasses. Oh, God, I couldn't stop crying. Oh, it was like a nightmare. How the hell do you play in glasses cricket? There were no contact lenses then, you know. It's very difficult for people to think. It wasn't, you know, late 50s. My mother was at her wit's end. I found out years later. She spoke to my Uncle Algie. He gave me a right cussing and dressing down one day. That if I was the sort of lad he thought I was, I had to pick myself up and, you know... And there's a guy at Warwickshire called Mike Smith. He plays in glasses. He's pretty good. And so I wrote to him. And he wrote back. I've lost the letter. I know it was on headed paper with the bear and the staff. And I told Mike about it when he captained me for England. And he said that he had got plastic lenses. So if the ball hit, it didn't splinter into your eye. They would crack or so, but they wouldn't go in your eye. That's always the danger. And... what many people forget, there were no helmets worn and grills until 1978. So we were quite a long way away from that. And that helped. I got some specially made glasses. You could see you didn't have rims all the way around. You only had rims at the top. So you had a bit better vision. You had no rim at the bottom or sides. I picked myself up and went on. But it was a tough time. And it virtually kiboshed my football career.
Yeah, so what happened? I mean, you just... It was difficult to play with glasses at football, was it?
Possible. I didn't know anybody who played in glasses, do you?
No.
I mean, I played at Leeds United. I played in the under-18 side. And that's why I'm fond of Leeds a bit. If the first team were playing, they'd give us two tickets to stand and watch the first team at 3 o'clock. And that's how I saw the great John Charles. He was probably the greatest all-round footballer Great Britain's ever produced. And I'll repeat that, all-round footballer. He could play centre-half or centre-forward. Because when he first played for Leeds, they put him at centre-half. And even Alex Ferguson, one of his books, said he was picking his greatest British team, first name on the sheet. He was 6'2", built like a brick, what have you. It was to kick him and what have you in those days. He used to look down on him with disdain. He's a waste of time. He was a big man. Huge he was, and got loads of goals. He was the first British player to be bought abroad. He went to Juventus, I think, for something like £65,000. I mean, today, it won't buy the little pinky of some of them, would it? £65,000.
Wasn't your real footballing hero Dennis Law?
He was, without a shadow of a doubt. My Uncle Jack. He got a motorbike and sidecar. And he took me to Huddersfield Town, who were in the second division. And I remember, I can't remember which match, I can't remember what date. But when the match was played, it was tough in those. As I said, they used to get away with kicking you and all kinds of things. It was quite rough as well as skillful. There was this scrawny kid. A real spindly kid with his collar up and his sleeves down and he's holding them and as if a puff of wind would blow him away until the ball came. Then he was like lightning. Oh, fell in love with him. Yeah, definitely. I went two or three times to watch him and I think he got sold to Manchester City for a record. Then Torino bought him in Italy. And he couldn't settle. It's just a different way of life. And Man United then bought him in 1962. And I went over the Pennines to watch him. Quite a way then, motorways and what have you. I went over to watch him play and then fell in love with him and Bobby Charlton. And then I was lucky after them came the genius, George Best. If you see Messi play, then you want to watch some of the pictures of him. That's how he was. He once went past one of the full-backs, nutmegged him, went round, got the ball, nutmegged him back. Instead of just going on with the ball, he could tease you and make you look silly. Yeah, he was just... I met him a number of times. The first time I met Dennis, though, was 2 years later. We're playing at Old Trafford for England, my first set of tests for England. In 64 was the fourth test at Old Trafford. And it was the one where Bobby Simpson batted 2 and a bit days and got 300, batted England out of the series, out of the test. I didn't get a bat till, oh, Christ, it was like Saturday. Saturday afternoon we batted. I didn't declare till just before lunch on Saturday morning, 2 and a bit days. And John Edwards and I went in to bat. I made 58, bowled by McKenzie. And then rest day Sunday and Monday, good pitch. Alan Thompson of the Daily Express came and said, listen, can you get away for an hour or more? I said, oh no, I'll ask the captain. So I asked Ted Dexter. Well, Barrington made 200 and Ted Dexter made 170 odd, so I got away, went over and met Dennis. All of them were playing cricket with a softball under the main stand, which is now the Bobby Charlton stand. They were playing cricket with a bat and a softball. It's now called the Bobby Charlton stand. It wasn't then. He had to retire. Bob was there, all of them, and I met my hero.
Playing cricket.
Playing cricket, they were.
And were they interested in cricket? Like
some of them were, Bobby, but Dennis is no bloody good. He said...
George Best, was he interested in cricket?
Yeah, he was. He was interested because he was big friends with Michael Parkinson, so was I. He used to stay at Michael's house like I did. in his house at Bray on the Thames. And so we talked about each other. But I met George at Man United. I met him a number of times. He's a beautiful boy. No wonder girls liked him. He was good looking, but he was nice. He wasn't nasty with him. Got gorgeous blue eyes. He just...
He had a soft voice as well, didn't he?
He's lovely.
Come hither eyes, yeah.
He just ran away from pressure in the end.
Yeah. We jumped ahead a little bit. I forgot to ask you, your first match for Yorkshire. What was that game?
I can never forget my first match for Yorkshire. I just made 200s for Yorkshire seconds. One in the Roses match. That's big. Yorkshire Lancashire was then.
Even seconds.
Big. I'd got 280 not out in three games. So I think the committee decided to give me a game. I play against the Pakistanis at Bradford, 1962. I'm 21. I got out to Anton D'Souza, medium fast bowler, for 4 and 4. I got bowled and caught behind, and balls that zipped and lifted. That was quite an eye-opener, let me tell you. Yeah, it was... Nobody else got many runs. It was...
Were you opening?
Yeah. It was quite a pitch, was Bradford. When I got to play, we as a team, liked playing there years later when I played. It was a result pitch. It seemed a bit on the morning. Got a bit easier then. Then it turned. Certainly turned within... day and two-thirds. There were club pitches, you see. Counties then played on club grounds. We played on about 7 or 8 in Yorkshire. And then to have the professional staff to have their own ground, like Headingley, and own pitches. No, you use the club grounds. And what was all right for 80, 90 overs on a club game on a Saturday with club bowlers, once you got better bowlers bowling and it's over 3 days, it started to disintegrate a bit. So there were result pitches, which Yorkshire were happy with. Not easy batting sometimes, but you got results. You're better winning 3 and losing 1 than getting 4 draws. You got more points.
How did you recover from that first game then?
With difficulty. I played the next game at Northampton. I got out to Albert Lightfoot for 10 in the middle order this time. I don't think Albert Lightfoot is remembered as a great bowler, like Anton D'Souza. But they were all too good for me. And then I was given these 3 matches. I played at Chesterfield. And who should I get them but Les Jackson? Remember him?
Yeah.
I heard of him. Everybody says, if Fred Truman, Brian Statham hadn't been playing for England, they weren't 2 great bowlers, like Flavel and Colwell at Worcester and Les Jackson at Derbyshire, they would have played a lot more tests. He was lively, fast, medium and zipped it around. But I played well. And by playing well, the third match I got 47, 30-odd not out or something. And I began to think then, maybe I could play. Maybe I could. Because it's tough when you first step up. For bowlers, everybody, it's just a tougher game, bigger game. So you have to be put in there, shoved in there, fail, pick yourself up and get on with it. Occasionally an odd player will come as a youngster and do well straight away. But it still doesn't guarantee he's going to be a success. So I did well against Jackson.
So that was a sort of breakthrough innings?
That was me. 3 matches and the last one I did good.
And what happened after that? So when was your first 100 for Yorkshire?
Well, the following year, 1963. So I'm 22 then. I didn't get in the first few matches. I wasn't picked, wasn't thought good enough. But they got some injuries. I couldn't tell you which one was in. I think it was probably Ken Taylor, but I couldn't tell you for sure. And you had a telegram from Mr. Nash, the secretary, would you join the first team? And it was to play at Gravesend against Kent. Yeah, but where the hell's Gravesend? I had no idea. I mean, I'd never been out of Yorkshire except when Yorkshire Seconds played Durham Seconds or Lancashire Seconds. Warwickshire Seconds, I think. Other than that, I don't think I've been anywhere. A couple of minor counties. Oh. So I had to find my way without a car, to Gravesend on the east coast there. God in heaven. I don't know how I did it. Got there and played. I think I made a couple of 20s. One not out, and we won the match late on. And somebody's still injured, so I went up for the Roses match at Bramall Lane, Sheffield, Whitsuntide. And we bowled Lancashire out, and then there were good nets at Bramall Lane. Asked the captain, Closey, could I go and practice? Well, Mel Ryan was 12th man, went to bowl with me, and then suddenly somebody came running, hadn't been there long, saying, look, the captain wants you back, wants you to get padded up. We were three down against Statham, Higgs and Lever for 50, I think. And Closey, instead of him batting above me, I was batting six. He'd bowled 25 overs and got three wickets and said he was a bit tired, put me in. Because you had a rest day then started again Monday. I went in, I think it was about 19 not out. And then come Monday morning, bank holiday Monday, big crowd, big, beautiful day. I made my first 100 against those three, which was pretty good. Yorkshire Lancashire was big, let me tell you, was huge. And I was bowled out by Tommy Greenough, I remember it now, in the footholds, just outside leg stump. I made 145. And Brian Stott made 143 left-handed. We put on 249 runs and we won the match. Easily, second in, bowled them out. And that was, you know, huge. Lancashire, and I batted up my skin. I did bat well.
First one of 151.
Well, you don't know where you're going when you start, do you? You just start and you just want to play cricket and you don't know where you're going to finish up. I didn't. I mean, all my career, until I got my first hundreds, maybe first few hundreds, people at Yorkshire cricket and coaches that, they all thought, players did too, that John Hampshire was going to be the best young cricketer. He was better than me. He got in the team before me, got in the under-15s before me, Yorkshire schoolboys, he got in the under-18s, 2 years. They all thought he was like... Duncan Fernley was a very fine left-handed bat. He did all those. Jackie Birkinshaw too. I was like behind all them. Yeah, obviously decent, but there were.
So, what was it that you had in the end that they didn't?
That's a question. That's a good question. But for me to answer it, I had a good technique. I think I had a better technique than them. Through John Lawrence, had a really good technique. I had determination, concentration I was blessed with. I don't care who would bowl at me, he'd get tired before I did. I don't care who, anybody in the world. I really fancied I could bat for long periods. I could concentrate without making mistakes. I had patience and bloody determination. You need that. But one thing I had was I was prepared to learn. Because I don't care how good a young player you are, unless you're Don Bradman, that good, somebody like him, we all are not the finished article. You should be good enough to play, to move up to whatever level, the next level, and then move up again. But you're not the finished article. And you have to watch and learn, improve, get better. Then one day, you'll be the best player. And I think I was prepared. I watched everybody bat. I watched every ball. I didn't go and mope around or go to sleep. I watched the cricket. I loved the cricket.
You sort of absorbed it all, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I took it all in and I watched. Mm. I think learning, adapting, is not often mentioned. So I like to watch players when I see them. I want to watch how they develop, how they think. I can watch the technique. I can see that pretty quickly. Oh, yeah, it's pretty good. But then what's he going to do with it? How's he going to think when he gets in tough situations? When that Joel Garner bowls you five overs and you haven't scored a run, and at the other end, Malcolm Marshall is standing at your block off, or Michael Holt is bowling like the wind and it's whistling past your head, you ain't going anywhere for an hour, are you? You ain't getting any half volleys. As I said to Michael once, I said, Michael, I said, this young lad Nasser's saying he's got a good cover drive. He said, we don't bowl any half volleys, Geoffrey. Michael, he said, we don't bowl any half volleys. I said, well, I've told him. He better learn some other shots because he won't be hitting it inside out through the covers. No ways. And they don't allow you to hook it. They're a bit too quick for that, so you better find some other way.
Okay, well, I hope you found Geoffrey Boycott's recap of the first half of his life, at least, interesting. A lot more of that is covered in the new issue of the Cricketer magazine. We've done about 10 pages on Boycott's life in the new Cricketer, which is available at www.thecricketer.com/subscribe. Also, lots of other interesting stuff, of course, in the mag as well. But we featured Geoffrey as his 80th birthday is coming up soon. So the second part of that interview will be in about a week's time, just before his actual birthday. And just again, another little mention of our evening on Thursday night, 7 p.m, with Angus Fraser, Simon and I interviewing him and getting into all sorts of cricket chat. I hope you can join us for that. See you then, and thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.